This is Cincinnati Edition. On 91.7 WVXU, I'm Michael Monks. A 23-year-old man is now behind bars after telling local police that he was a missing boy from Illinois. That missing boy, Timothy Pitson, has been missing for roughly 8 years and would only be 14 today. So what prompted the FBI and other investigators to conduct a DNA test on the Medina, Ohio man who allegedly lied about his identity? A news conference is wrapping up in downtown Cincinnati. We will get a full report on the latest coming up later in the show, and there are some strange new details already emerging on social media about this. But first, let's start with the news from around Ohio. The gas tax is going up.
The state made a case that between $500 and $550 million was what they needed in the first year, and this reached that goal, and it provided a lot of critical money needed by the locals as well. So, yes, I was pleased with this.
That was Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder talking about the gas tax spike. And that's not the only new legislation that is being floated or is now law out of Columbus. So let's discuss that now with Cincinnati Inquirer Columbus Bureau Chief Jackie Borchardt. Welcome, Jackie.
Good afternoon.
And we also have Ohio Public Radio State House Bureau's Joe Ingles. Thanks for being here, Joe.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
And WVXU Senior Political Analyst Howard Wilkinson. Welcome back, Howard.
Thank you.
If you've got questions or comments about these topics as we discuss them, give us a call. We'll take your call, 513-419-7100. You can also email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. And we'll find your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those in the show as well. Jackie, we just heard from Larry Householder there in that soundbite talking about the gas tax. What happened?
That's a great question. Well, you know, Governor Mike DeWine came in with a big ask of an 18 cent per gallon increase. That would be the first gas tax increase since 2004 when Larry Householder was speaker before. And, you know, he was pushing really hard for 18 cents. You know, the language that they used to try to sell that steep of a hike was that people will die. We need this to, you know, maintain our roads. And the House took it down to 10.7 cents and slapped on a hike for diesel. And then the Senate took it down to 6 cents. So over the last couple of weeks, you've really seen the House and the Senate kind of going back and forth and really, you know, kind of arguing over what that gas tax number should be. And it did hold up the whole transportation budget bill a couple of days past the official deadline. But they ended up settling at 10.5 cents, which is pretty close to what the House had proposed.
So the total now is what, 38.5 cents a gallon?
38.5 cents a gallon, and then 47 cents on diesel.
Okay, so this wasn't entirely what Governor DeWine was asking for, but do they have any indication of where they plan to deploy these new resources?
That's to be determined. The Department of Transportation under DeWine had pitched 18 cents as what was needed to maintain roads and bridges and new projects for about 10 years. And remember, he also wanted to index the gas tax to inflation so that, you know, they wouldn't have to go through this again down the road. And what the legislature settled on is really more of like a 4 to 6 year amount that will fund projects. And of course, you know, they haven't decided on that. That'll be decided in the next couple months what those priority projects are. The DeWine administration has said they want to prioritize safety projects. They've identified some like 150 spots around the state that are really like the most dangerous locations, and they want to, you know, try to address those first. But the legislature also put a study committee, they love those, into this bill to kind of look at what maybe we could do in the future besides raising the gas tax. There's a couple different ideas that are being used in other states, such as like measuring the exact mileage, for example, that you drive in a year and paying a tax based on that. So, you know, they did this hike, but they're also saying, hey, we should look at, you know, what we can do in the future to avoid doing this and maybe raise revenue a different way.
Because the issues have been that not only has the gas tax been flat for many years, but cars are using less gas.
I mean, that's part of it. And, you know, also in this is an annual fee on hybrids and plug-in hybrids and electric vehicles to try to get at the issue of fairness that, you know, these vehicles get better gas mileage, they use less gas, so the drivers are, you know, paying less gas tax, yet they're still using the roads, maybe the same as someone who drives a full gasoline-powered vehicle. You know, trucks, the diesel tax, I think was really important for the Ohio House because of this idea that trucks, you know, put more wear and tear on the roads. So they should, you know, be paying a little bit more of their fair share. Fairness was kind of something that was part of this discussion more so than I think anyone anticipated.
Joe, there was a lot of back and forth as this gas tax was considered in Columbus. What was the motivation behind the pushback? Who were the people against it?
Oh, well, there were a lot of people against it. You know, the Ohio Chamber of Commerce, the business community, they don't like the idea of this gas tax on the diesel. They say that's going to raise the cost of goods and services. And if you look at the general public, you know, a lot of people are on social media responding to newspaper things and saying, you know, and on radio shows saying, we don't want to be taxed. And the Senate was hearing that. So senators were saying, you know, we're hearing from our constituents. They don't like this idea. We don't want to raise the tax. You know, we don't want to raise the tax that much. There were a lot of people who were pushing back on it. But in the end, lawmakers had to come up with something. And someone had to pay. And this is the way that they're doing it. But they made it a shorter term, basically, so that they could, you know, look at it again and take another swipe at it, as Jackie said.
Joe, what was the partisan breakdown of this vote? What did it split the parties at all?
You know, it went across the parties. Both Republicans and Democrats voted for it. And one of the things that they did to sweeten the pot for the Democrats was they threw in some money for transportation, public transportation. And that was something that, you know, the state wasn't spending much on it at all. And they threw in a bunch more. What was it? $70 million. And so anyway, they threw that money in there, and that swayed the Democrats, a lot of the Democrats. But then, you know, we're also hearing from the Democrats that this is a regressive tax, and they would like to get back to the point where, you know, people pay based on, you know, how much they earn and that sort of thing, a more fair tax so that the low wage earners are not hit disproportionately.
Howard, let's bring you in because it's somewhat unusual, I suppose, for a new Republican administration to start off their term with a push for a tax increase. So tell us the thoughts behind this and how this plays out politically.
Well, obviously, they don't like this at all. And when Mike DeWine came up with the 18-cent figure, that was pretty much dead on arrival, and I think he knew it. You know, he knew he'd have to compromise with the legislature. You got to look at some of these, the state senators in particular, Republicans, but also some Democrats. They like the idea of someday having congressmen in front of their names, and if they end up running at some point, they are probably going to face a primary against some very conservative, fiscally conservative Republican who is going to be screaming bloody murder that they had increased taxes for all Ohioans. And that's just not going to go over very well. So it's really tough. It's a tough vote for them.
So Mike DeWine ran last year in this election saying that if you vote for Democrat Richard Cordray, he's going to raise your taxes right off the bat.
Yeah.
Turns out, they did vote for Mike DeWine. He got into office, and he raised the taxes right off the bat.
Funny how that works. Isn't it?
It is funny how that works.
Yeah. I don't think that DeWine was aware of the magnitude of the issue of the transportation funding.
True.
I mean, it definitely came up last year, and if you remember, Richard Cordray had proposed a big infrastructure bond plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, once DeWine was elected and he was briefed more in depth on the situation, I mean, the decision that he made in his proposal was, we're not going to borrow more money. You know, under the Kasich administration, we bonded against the Turnpike, which generated, you know, I think over $1 billion, and then also bonded other projects. So right now, according to ODOT, the state is paying about $390 million a year just in those debt payments. And I think the total debt is somewhere near $4 billion. So that's certainly an option, but for Mike DeWine, that wasn't an option to, you know, take out the credit card again.
You mentioned the ODOT study of the 150 most dangerous intersections in the state of Ohio. And after DeWine became governor, a Coleraine Township police officer was killed at one of those intersections while he was out of his cruiser investigating another accident. And I think that struck a lot of people. And, you know, already this year, there has been a death of a police officer at one of these very dangerous intersections.
That wasn't the only vehicle-related legislation, though, the increase in the gas tax. We are also seeing a change to the way that we handle license plates. Jackie, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, this was another kind of sticking point during the negotiations between the House and the Senate. And for, I don't know, decades now, it's been debated at the State House whether Ohio should scrap the requirement to have a second license plate on the front bumper. And it's made it into various bills in recent years, but it actually stayed all the way through this time. And so starting in July of 2020, Ohioans will no longer need to have a front license plate. If you already have one, you can keep it. They're not going to come in and take it away from you. One thing, you know, DeWine said he was not very comfortable with that particular provision. Law enforcement have fought that type of a change for years because they say that the front license plate really helps them in a number of ways. And a major way is that they're able to scan front license plates at a much higher rate than they are rear license plates. And different law enforcement agencies across the state actually have databases, short-term databases, where they collect this information, and they've used it to, find someone in a hit-and-run type incident. They've used it to, I think the funniest story I heard last week was, like, reunite someone with their dogs. So it's used in a variety of ways. And so DeWine did not veto that part of the bill. He left it in there. And he, when asked about it, he said that hopefully by 2020, by next July, they'll figure something out with law enforcement to hopefully minimize the impact of removing that requirement for their purposes.
Joe, what was the motivation behind getting rid of that front license plate?
Well, you know, it's funny because a lot of these people who have these sport cars or these, you know, really super fancy cars, the license plate actually has to be drilled into that front bumper. And if you're trading your car across state lines, a front bumper that has plates, holes for plates, doesn't do you much good in Indiana or Pennsylvania or Michigan or Kentucky or, you know, another state where they're not required to have front plates. So you have two holes in your bumper. That just immediately hurts the value. That was one thing that was made. But a lot of people just don't like the idea of having to have front plates on their car. I mean, that's what it comes down to. And it's been a big argument for a long time now. And, as Jackie said, the Highway Patrol would and the officers would love to have that because, you know, it helps them. But, a lot of people see that as a big, you know, downside, too, because they think it's easier to get caught for speeding or whatever. And so, you know, I think it's been going on. Governor DeWine says it's been going on since he was in the state legislature, and that was 30 years ago. So it's a long debate. But, you know, it's funny because he didn't veto any part of this. And when he was asked about the transportation budget and why he didn't veto something, he said basically it was a package. It was a deal that, you know, they made and that he would come back and revisit some things in it that, you know, that in separate legislation or in a separate way if he wanted to, you know, in the future. But he said, you know, this was a deal and I'm not going to, you know, go back and do anything and try to push any buttons. So,
yeah, I just kind of think it's a lame excuse. The two drilled holes in your front bumper. You know, if the car ends up in Pennsylvania, okay, take a specialty unofficial plate that says "Go Steelers" or something, and put it on the front of your car. If you trade that off against the benefit that it can have for law enforcement, and it really can. I've heard that from, you know, many police officers over the years. I just don't think it's a very good trade-off.
You know, one thing that Speaker Householder was pointing out yesterday, and I thought about it, and it is kind of true, at least with my car, some of these cars have technology in the bumper. It's actually built in so that, you know, you don't hit the car in front of you or something stupid like that. And that's in your bumper. And so if you've got, you know, people drilling in there to do license plates and you've already got some technology in there, there's a chance that you could damage something. So that was another reason.
The other reason that has come up in the past, especially former state rep Alicia Reese from Cincinnati had brought this up. This was kind of a big issue for her. She had proposed a standalone bill in the last session. And it's, you know, that having that front plate, if you don't have a front plate, that is a reason for an officer to pull you over. And, you know, so there are concerns that with racial profiling, that it may lead to more instances where, you know, people of color are pulled over by an officer for not having the front plate. And it, you know, could lead to, you know, I'm reminded of Sam DuBose.
Exactly. This was Sam DuBose who was pulled over by a University of Cincinnati police officer and ultimately shot and killed during that encounter. The initial reason for pulling over was a lack of a front plate.
Correct.
Yes.
You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're talking today about some Ohio news with Cincinnati Inquirer Columbus Bureau Chief Jackie Borchardt. And we've got Ohio Public Radio State House Bureau reporter Joe Ingles and WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. Join the conversation at 513-419-7100. Email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. So we've got some changes to charter schools and the formula that funds them. Tell us a little bit about that, Jackie.
Well, this week, was it this week?
Yeah.
Wow. Late last week.
We're
I think
all
it was
on
last
the same
Friday.
Page.
Yeah. Yeah. Late last Friday, the numbers were released for there's a pair of lawmakers in the House who have proposed a bipartisan school funding plan. And so late last Friday, we found out exactly how that formula might work with our school districts, with the 610 school districts across the state. And what that allowed us to do is kind of actually see, like, all of these formula ideas always sound good on the outset, right? Like, we're going to direct more money to poor schools and to, you know, more rural schools that need it. But then when you actually see how the numbers shake out, you're able to, you know, tell a little bit more about what's in the formula and how it works. So what we found is that they're estimating about $720 million additional over current funding levels in the next 2 years to fully fund their plan, which is a huge chunk of change, especially considering that legislative analysts think that DeWine's initial budget projections are off by several hundred million dollars. So that's kind of the first question is, where are you going to get this money? The second thing that this formula does that's getting some attention is that it takes the mechanism of funding charter schools outside of the traditional formula. So currently, charter schools are funded by, you know, on a per student basis, and that money is deducted from that student's home school district. And what they're proposing is it's going to be funded by the state separate from the funding formula. And that's something that everyone seems to kind of be in agreement about. There are some concerns, though, that they want to make sure that funding is always there and available and can't just easily be wiped away. So those are some of the big things. People are still working through this. They're taking testimony on the bill next week. They've opened it up to the public. This week they had mostly school administrators who helped work on this plan. And that's another thing that sets us apart. You know, Ohio's been trying to do this for 20 some odd years, 22 years since the DeRolf decision. And this plan is a little bit different in that it seems to have buy-in from educators. Like, even in districts where they're not going to see a huge increase of money or no new money in a couple years, they seem to believe at least in the formula and the way that it's computed and that it's fair.
And one thing to remember here is that Governor DeWine has called for wraparound services where you would have address these school districts would be able to address issues of need, either for mental health or for physical health or, you know, all kinds of different needs that might arise, especially in those disadvantaged communities. And so, you know, if you're evening out this formula like you know, the Cupp-Patterson plan that's being considered now, there could be some wraparound money that would come into some of those districts that's maybe not getting an increase now, but they need help. they could get that wraparound money in a separate form, a separate fashion. And so that's kind of attractive to some of those districts that aren't getting money. That's the one thing they look at and they think, well, maybe we'll make up in that way.
Joe, this is something we've been hearing about since the 2016 election, certainly, and maybe off and on before that, and that is whether we need to move away from the Electoral College and to a nationwide popular vote to decide who occupies the White House every 4 years. And it looks like some Electoral College reform supporters are starting a ballot effort in Ohio. Tell us about it.
Right. I think we've been hearing about that since the Gore-Bush election back in, what year was that? Anyway.
Or maybe the Hayes-Tilden election back in 1870.
It's been a long time, let's put it that way. But there's a national group out there, and they have been trying to go with the popular vote, get rid of this electoral vote. And, of course, people who want to get rid of the electoral vote, largely a lot of Democrats, basically, say, you know, the person who gets the most votes should win. And we shouldn't have an electoral college that goes against the people because, of course, we know that President Trump got fewer votes than Hillary Clinton. But look who's sitting in the White House, and that's due to this electoral college and the electoral votes that go with it. So, you know, this national group is out there, and they're going to different states, and different states have signed on to this compact that would say, hey, you know, we're going to go with the popular vote in our state, basically wiping out the electoral vote in the different states. Now, you know, the reason the electoral vote was put there historically was so that you didn't have a candidate going to the big states and, you know, counting up the biggest states and then say, okay, that's where we're going to campaign. We're going to put all our money there. And if we can get them to, you know, go along with us, we're elected. So that's who we're beholden to. And it's supposed to give, you know, communities, states that basically have maybe different needs than others, give them a seat at the table and, you know, the opportunity to get a president that more represents them. But in recent years, there's been a lot of questions as to whether that is actually happening. And there, as more money has come into the campaigns, that's even made a, you know, more of a question.
Howard, Al Gore and yes, Hillary Clinton are two Democrats this century who have won the popular vote but lost the Electoral College and subsequently, of course, the White House with that. So does a national popular vote favor Democratic candidates?
Well, I think it certainly does now, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, you can't look at the 2016 election results and conclude anything else. A Democrat head-to-head with a Republican running for president is going to win the popular vote. I don't know. I mean, I've thought about this for a long time, and there's another alternative that a lot of Democrats don't really like, but it's a possibility, and I just want to put it on the table. Let's say we had an electoral college, and the votes were distributed by congressional district. You win a congressional district, you win that one vote. In a state, if you win the majority of those congressional districts, you get the two extras. And in that way, you would have states like California, where Republicans have no chance whatsoever to pick up any votes, could pick up at least a few votes, or Texas, where Democrats have no chance to win the state as a whole, could pick up a district here or there and at least get something out of
even
it.
Even Kentucky could then be
Kentucky
in play for some Democrats.
Could
they
be,
could take the Louisville or Lexington districts.
Exactly. They could take a few districts. And it would I don't know. It's never going to happen, but that's my little –
We're the world, Howard Wilkinson's.
Little, right, yeah.
Well, there's somebody –
Howard makes a really good point. I mean, it's really the winner-take-all
right.
Setup yeah. that the states have. And under that, you know, if you live in New York or Texas, you don't get the same attention. You don't ever see the candidates in the way that – we in Ohio get to see the candidates are now, you know, like we're expecting Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania to really be in play. So I know that's kind of an argument. It would make the candidate a different method, like Howard's suggesting, would make the candidates really try to have a broader appeal and really travel the country instead of really only going to the battleground states.
Well, there is one Ohioan who is certainly thinking about electoral votes these days, Democratic Congressman Tim Ryan Howard. He announced that he's going to be seeking the Democratic presidential nomination. I think we're the only ones at this point not seeking that nomination. So who is Tim Ryan? What are his chances, Howard?
Well, Tim Ryan's a congressman from Niles, Ohio, from up northeast, has represented the Mahoning Valley for a long time. Has been very popular in his congressional district. Has done very well. And I think Jackie and Joe would agree with this, that many times over the years I have heard from Congressman Ryan about, you know, Howard, I'm considering running for the Senate, or I'm considering running for governor, or I'm considering doing this. And he has never done it. Now, he's always pulled back and said no. Now, this sounded a little more affirmative when he got on and started talking about this on The View, I guess. And he sounded a little more affirmative, and he sounded like the kind of populist-type candidate that Sherrod Brown was, only a little bit not quite as skilled at the message as Sherrod Brown.
So who's his base? I mean, who's running over to the Tim Ryan column now?
Look, I mean, there is a base in Ohio, and you go up and down the Ohio River in the Mahoning Valley and in the steel areas, the Lordstowns, the coal country. Those are his people, and those same people live in Pennsylvania, they live in Wisconsin, they live in Michigan, they live in other places who might be receptive to his message. And those are very important states in the 2020 election.
Before I let you all go, I want to make sure that we get this call, and I think it's a question about some legislation. Hey, Carol on the line. Carol, how are you?
Hi, fine.
What's your question?
I wanted to go back to the gas tax. One thing I haven't heard is the impact on car maintenance when you're driving over bad roads as opposed to driving over good roads.
Okay, we'll hang up and let our Columbus reporters weigh in on that. If you didn't hear Joe and Jackie, Carol is asking about if there had been any consideration to the cost of people taking care of their cars when they're riding on some of these roughed up roads.
Well, I'm sure there, you know, a lot of people who have had their tires blown out by hitting a pothole probably would say, yep, there is a problem there.
So maybe paying a little bit more for gas and putting a little more money in the coffers to repair those roads is a way to offset? Is it a better investment?
It's certainly cheaper than tires.
I mean, I did hear that from a few lawmakers, like, you know, they travel from their hometowns to Columbus every week. They know what the roads are like. And yeah, you pay $300 if you pop one of your tires and you got maybe undercar damage, and the gas tax increase is going to be far, for most people, far, far, far less than that a year.
All right. I want to thank Cincinnati Inquirer Columbus Bureau Chief Jackie Borchardt, Ohio Public Radio State House reporter Joe Ingles, and WVXU Senior Political Analyst Howard Wilkins. Thanks to all of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Just ahead, the latest on the man who allegedly claimed to be a long-missing 14-year-old boy and an investigation into the Northern Kentucky University women's basketball team. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A news conference just wrapped up in downtown Cincinnati related to the 23-year-old man who allegedly claimed to be a long-missing 14-year-old boy. We're going to discuss what was learned just ahead. But first, Northern Kentucky University is investigating its women's basketball program after some players claim to have been victims of abuse under head coach Cameron Whitaker. Other players have come to the head coach's defense. Let's discuss with Cincinnati Inquirer higher education reporter Kate Murphy. Welcome back, Kate.
Thanks for having me.
If you've got questions or comments about this story, give us a call at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments or your tweets. Kate, let's start by talking about who Cameron Whitaker is and where she came from.
Yeah, so Coach Cameron Whitaker is the new head coach at Northern Kentucky University. She's been there for the past three seasons. And, you know, she has a pretty long coaching career up until then, starting first at Austin Peay in Tennessee and then working her kind of way up as an assistant coach there. And then at Western Kentucky, University of Dayton, Missouri State, University of Kentucky, which is how she eventually landed at Northern Kentucky. And that was her, you know, a big deal to be, you know, Division I first-time head coach for a program like that.
So the first thing we heard about this was a post to a blog by, I guess, a former player, mm-hmm. Taryn Togger. What did she say?
So, yeah, she was a senior this year and posted this blog, this article that she had written kind of describing her experience and the experiences of some of her teammates at NKU over the past couple of years. She talked or wrote a lot about intimidation from Coach Whitaker, isolating certain players and kind of pitting the team against each other, using players, in some cases, medical conditions, you know, as a form of punishment for the girls and kind of using that against them. And a lot of it was what she described were really verbal attacks on players' character. And, you know, she made it very, very clear, as did many other of the girls that I talked to. This wasn't about being yelled at on the court. This wasn't about doing a drill improperly or being lazy on the court or not boxing out. You know, they were used to that intense environment. It's a Division I program. Obviously, you're going to deal with the intensity from a coach and kind of that toughness. But for them, a lot of it felt like they were being attacked, their character, where they come from, and kind of feeling degraded as human beings versus as basketball players.
So some other players came out as well, Sheree Davis and Casey Utrecht. Mm-hmm. They've spoke out as well. Are other stories confirming one another's viewpoints and adding their own experiences as well?
Yeah, and I think that's the biggest thing that we're seeing here is that none of these players are they're all agreeing that all of these things happened. It might not have happened to them personally, but the instances and the examples that these people are giving from, you know, the talks and the crying couch in the office, the isolation of certain players and, you know, Sheree not or her, the coach telling people not to eat with Sheree when they go out to restaurants as a team, not to sit next to her on the bench, you know, trying to keep them separated and really kind of use that power in that way. And I mean, even if you look at the letter from the current players who are, you know, signed this letter of support for the coach, they don't address or refute any of the experiences of their former teammates. I think they're just, you know, kind of showing their support in that that wasn't my experience as a player. You know, for those girls, they have overall had a positive experience under their coach. And so that's where that support is coming from versus, you know, refuting the specific allegations that their other teammates are kind of alleging.
Yeah. So the remaining players, mm-hmm. the current team, I guess that will be back next year.
Right.
They issued a joint statement together. Were they all on board with that statement? Was there any indication that maybe a couple weren't, or was it unanimous?
I don't know that for sure. I mean, there were eight players that signed the letter. Each of them are planning to return. That doesn't include the names of three players who are listed on the roster this season who could come back next year. I don't know if, you know, there's no real way to confirm whether they're currently transferring or if they're quitting basketball altogether or quitting the team and staying at NKU. But there were three players that did not sign that letter who are currently on the roster and could potentially still be on the team next year.
Have we heard from Coach Whitaker at all?
No. I have reached out to her several times through, you know, the athletic department and through the university's you know, media relations, and they have not made her or any of the assistant coaches available for an interview or for any sort of comment.
So now the university is doing an investigation. What does this process look like?
So that's also kind of unclear what the investigation will look like. You know, the spokeswoman Anna Wright for NKU said they're, you know, looking into who will perform the investigation. It will be an outside firm, so it won't be done internally to kind of get that outside fresh perspective on an assessment and a review of this program as a whole. You know, they're hoping to do it as quickly as possible, but they also want to be thorough. And so I'm sure that will include interviews with former players, with coaching staff. And, you know, it's also, we're not sure how much it might cost. But those are all kind of things that they're figuring out now, I'm sure, as they proceed into looking into these allegations.
The NKU women's basketball program has a rich history. They won two national titles at the Division II level. And before the men's program started to steal the thunder in recent years, the women's program was first to emerge with postseason appearances in the transition to Division I. But they've had three losing seasons under Coach Whitaker in a row. And now this investigation is taking place. I mean, is there any indication or talk or rumblings that perhaps her job is on the line here?
I haven't heard that, but I mean, it's obviously we'll just have to wait and see kind of what comes from this review and whether it focuses. You know, I'm sure that as always with, you know, a coach, their, you know, performance reviews are come up often, and you know what their contracts are and that kind of thing, and so that will, I'm sure, be evaluated in light of all of this. But they have not, you know, released any information to indicate that her job is in danger.
So what's the timeline on this investigation?
They honestly haven't given any information about that. You know, like I said, they're looking for it to be done as quickly as possible, but as thoroughly as possible. So pretty vague in that sense. But, you know, hopefully, I'm sure by the end of the school year, you know, so that as new players come in, this issue is resolved for that upcoming preseason next year.
Do we know if Coach is working? I mean, is she recruiting? I would imagine this is the time of year where they're nailing down some recruits.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. You know, and this time of year is when a lot of different players across the country have signing days and that kind of thing. And, you know, starting to commit to schools, whether they're a junior or a senior in high school. So I'm not sure, you know, what her, obviously I haven't been able to talk to her or anyone in the athletic department directly about this, you know, and kind of what her status is as a coach or, you know, in her job, like going out on recruiting trips and that kind of thing.
Cincinnati Inquirer higher education reporter Kate Murphy, thanks for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Timothy Pitson has been gone without a trace for the past 8 years. His family got a lead this week when a man in Newport claimed to be him. A DNA test not only revealed otherwise, but further investigation identified this alleged boy as 23-year-old man Brian Rennie from Medina, Ohio, recently released from prison. A news conference in downtown Cincinnati wrapped up not long ago. So let's find out the latest with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Max Lonberg. Welcome back, Max.
Thank you.
And WVXU reporter Bill Reinhardt, who just hustled back. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Bill. So what happened at this news conference today?
They announced he has been charged with lying to a federal agent.
And that's the only charge?
That is the only charge.
And what type of penalty does that carry?
Up to 8 years if he is convicted. He was taken before a magistrate this morning. His next court appearance is Tuesday. He's being held by the U.S. Marshals. No bond set.
So this is a federal charge?
Yes.
Okay. So did we learn anything else about him in his past?
Well, he's done this a couple of times before.
What do you mean?
The U.S. District Attorney for the Southern District of Ohio, Ben Glassman, couldn't elaborate. But he says twice before he has passed himself off as the victim of sex trafficking.
Really? So like maybe you don't know for sure, but possibly real cases that have materials that prosecutors or investigators may have?
Yeah, I've seen other reporting on it, but haven't dove deep into it myself yet. So
Bill's catching his breath because he literally just ran in here from this news conference. Max, what a strange story. I mean, it just took so many turns over the past 48 hours. Give us the background first. Let's just remind the audience that there is an actual missing boy at the heart of this case. Tell us about him.
Timothy Pitson, he lived in Aurora, Illinois. He disappeared in May 2011 under some unusual circumstances. His mother pulled him from school, took him on a, you know, quick trip to the zoo and to a water park. And then after the boy was reported missing, she took her own life. And in a note that police credited to her, said that Timothy, the boy, was safe with a loved one, but would never be found. There have been some false sightings over the years, but nothing substantial, really, until Wednesday when, as far as I know, this was the first kind of huge lead in the case. But as it turns out, it was false.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. So it all starts a couple days ago with a report that possibly somebody claiming to be this missing boy has shown up in Newport. What happened?
Police received a call about what turned out to be Rini, but they received a call that it was a boy who looked lost, was asking for help. They responded. According to police scanner traffic that we obtained, police listed the name of this person as Timothy James Pitson. They listed his correct date of birth, and they said that he claimed that he had been kidnapped and he had been missing for 7 years, and he was being held against his will by two men. We later learned that that person declined to give fingerprints but did agree to a swab, continued to claim he was Timothy Pitson over about a 36-hour period. But when the DNA results came back, it matched not Timothy but Brian Rini. So that's where we are.
It would seem as though Brian Rini does some research before he goes into these situations.
Brian Rini knew a lot about the case. I will say a lot about the case is out there. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children had, I believe, all of the information that he gave to police, you know, right there on their website. So
yeah, it's all there, the background. Right. And then, of course, you can Google the news results from their local media.
District Attorney Ben Glassman did say that Rini saw a 2020 rerun, 2020 on ABC, had a special on it and reran it recently, and they double-checked on that.
Gosh. That.
Yep, that's where that looks like where it all started.
Okay, so here's the thing. So, like, when we first hear that this missing Illinois boy may have been in Newport, we all start looking at this photo, right? The photo of Timothy when he was six,
right,
and then the age-progressed photo of what he may look like at age 14.
Yeah, and I think for the public, they saw that, and I don't think a lot of people made the distinction that that was an age-progressed,
right,
computer-generated photo of,
yes,
people. I think I heard a lot of people on Twitter saying, well, it looks just,
exactly,
like him.
Exactly, and it did look just like them because they're very talented in this,
yes,
sort of age progression
thing. Actual photo, not so much.
That's what I'm going to question next is, then we finally learn that a guy named Brian Rini may be involved in some mass deception here, and we see his mugshot. And he doesn't look not only like not a teenager, but not like this boy at all. So were there any questions, Bill, asked at the news conference about why this guy was given the benefit of the doubt at all? I mean,
yeah,
he doesn't look like a 14-year-old.
Well, I said, you know, there were some suspicions, but they have to check.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's entirely possible. And a kid that's been missing that long, God only knows what's happened to him. What kind of state physically is he in? So they had to assume, they had to double check and make sure, because what if it was him and they went, keep moving.
What do we know, Max, about Brian Rini before this case?
Sure. He does have a criminal record. He, I believe it was in 2017, I'm guessing here, a couple years ago, he went into a neighborhood to look at a home, and he later showed up 2 days later and told neighbors, hey, I'm going to throw a party tonight. I just moved in. I'm a new neighbor. Come on over. But in fact, he hadn't purchased the home. He was later charged with burglary and vandalism. He spent some time in prison. He was recently released just on March 7th, so last month. He also, as Bill mentioned, he has a couple of these. He's been accused of making false statements in the past about being a child sex trafficking victim. And I believe there are a couple other smaller cases about passing bad checks and things of that nature.
We heard from his brother, I believe.
Yeah, Jonathan. Jonathan has spoken to some media outlets. He said Brian does have a history of mental illness. Jonathan said that his brother impersonated him in a traffic stop. So Brian Reaney was stopped and told police, "I'm Jonathan. It wasn't actually Jonathan." So at that point, Jonathan said he stopped talking to his brother after he was impersonated by him to police.
And apparently has some long history with mental illnesses. That's what I had seen a television interview with the brother, Jonathan, who suggested
that's
that.
That's what the brother says, yep.
There was just about everyone you could rattle off. He was rattling them off, ADHD and bipolar disorder and all those different things that he was struggling with. Let's just recap for those of you who may just be joining us. 23-year-old Brian Reaney faces a federal charge of lying to a federal agent this week. This is all related to his alleged impersonation of a missing 14-year-old boy named Timothy Pitson. Bill Reinhart from WVXU reported that the prosecutor in this case, the district attorney in this case, said...
Ben Glassman. He says when they took Reaney over to Children's Hospital to get some complaints about abdominal pain checked out, an FBI agent went in, identified herself as an FBI agent. He doubled down on his claim that he was Timothy, and that after that, they came up with the DNA... And that showed it was not a match, and that's when they charged him.
And I want to reiterate that this all followed an apparent recent rerun of an episode of 2020 that focused on this case. So this child, Timothy Pitson, has been missing for almost 8 years. He's been featured on national television. 2020 gets a pretty large audience, but I can't imagine that his case has ever gotten as large an audience as it has in the past 48 hours. Number one trending topic was this child's name. Is there any indication that this helps the investigation or the search for him?
The FBI says they are still looking for him. They didn't go as far to say, yeah, this is going to help us. But they did say, if anyone does know anything about Timothy, we want to know. They also want to know what Reaney's been up to since he was let out of prison. And they're asking that anyone has information about his activities over the last couple of weeks. Give the FBI a call, they say.
Because when he showed up in Newport, at least what we had heard from initial reports, that he was described by witnesses as looking like he had been abused.
Assaulted, beaten, bruised,
but they
tired,
don't know what
scared.
Happened.
No idea what he's been up to in the last couple of weeks.
I imagine Timothy Pitson's family in Illinois must be dealing with a lot. Max, have we heard from them at all?
We have. They have been dealing with a lot. They were hopeful, as one would expect. They gave a brief press conference, and when they said I think it was the grandmother of Timothy said she feels like they're back at ground zero. They continue to hope. On the topic of how this could help the case in a sort of perverse way, a sergeant with Aurora Police Department, which is the department handling the missing person case, he did say this could help. It brings more awareness to it, has more eyes now looking at it in a different way. So a lot of people hoping Timothy is found.
What about the residents of Newport who encountered who we now know to be Brian Reaney? Do they feel any sense of embarrassment or naivety?
I don't know that they have. I've seen interviews with him since then, and I don't know that anyone's blaming them.
Yeah,
I don't know that anyone feels embarrassed for them, but what do you do when someone comes up and says, hey, I'm a 14-year-old, I've been abducted, I've been missing? You help them.
Bill Reinhart from WVXU and Max Lonberg from the Cincinnati Inquirer, thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our show online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.